They bought drugs for me. They bought me clothes. They took me out to eat. They took care of my needs and made it real easy for me to just keep going on with that lie. I was a witness, under oath, describing how New Haven police detectives maintained her cooperation for a testimony that sent two men to prison for a combined 106 years. Her name was Miss Stiles. And what they bought with those meals and those drugs is the subject of everything we're about to discuss. This is the Hidden Ledger Podcast. Welcome to part two of A Settling of Accounts, The Price of Every Brick. In our last chapter, Detective Vincent Rauchy manufactured a double murder conviction from a teenager's coerced testimony and a $10,000 grudge. Two men went to prison, one for 120 years, one for 70. The FBI found evidence of coercion. The Department of Justice declined to prosecute. Rauchy resigned with a pension. The architecture held. Tonight, we're going to talk about the price. So how much do you think a brick costs? A standard red clay facing brick runs at about 60 cents at volume. Serviceable, democratic, the kind of material you never really think about until the wall is already up. Connecticut brownstone, $30 a square foot. That's when you can get it at all. Most of the quarries, they closed a century ago. But in the interrogation rooms, in case files of the New Haven Police Department, a different kind of brick was being manufactured throughout the 1980s and 90s. This kind was paid for in a different currency altogether. Not dollars per square foot, years per fabricated witness, decades per suppressed confession. And every brick, it was bespoke, handcrafted by detectives who learned to read a person's desperation the way a mason might read stone. A teenager with schizophrenia who wanted to go home. A woman convulsing from opioid withdrawal who needed a fix to stop the shaking. A 12-year-old boy brought in without his mother and told his cooperation would keep her out of jail. A witness followed to her home, her school, and her daughter's court hearings until she finally stopped saying no. Different hands, different rooms, different years. The same craft, the same result. Scott Lewis paid 19 years. Stephane Morant paid 21. Adam Carman paid 28. George Gould paid 26. 94 years. Four men. One blueprint. This is chapter two. You know some of this already. Scott Lewis, approximately 25 years old. No violent record. Leaving the drug trade for a career in real estate. Sentenced to 120 years for a double murder on the strength of a coached teenager and suppressed evidence. What you don't know yet is what happened next. What happened next took 19 years, seven judges who said no, one who said yes, a Yale law professor, and roughly 40 law students who refused to stop pulling at the thread. The state courts or a wall. Lewis filed his first habeas corpus petition in 2001, a legal challenge arguing that he was imprisoned unlawfully, 6 years into a 120-year sentence. He laid out the coerced testimony, the prosecutorial misconduct, the suppressed evidence. The court rejected it. He filed again in 2008, rejected again. Between those two petitions and every appeal attached to them, 7 state court judges examined the evidence. That Rauchy had coached Ruiz, that the supervising sergeant, Michael Sweeney, had watched it happen, that the prosecutors had concealed the death of a key informant, a man named Frank Graham, who had told police that someone else entirely, a man named Michael Caldwell, had confessed to the Turner Fields murder. 7 judges looked at all of that, and 7 judges said no. The system reviewed itself, and lo and behold, it found no problems. Then, Professor Brett Dingham got involved. Dingham taught at Yale Law School, and later Columbia. She took on Lewis's case and assembled a legal team that would eventually include roughly 40 law students working over several years. What they found, digging through the wreckage of a case that 7 judges had already blessed, was damning enough that a federal court was willing to do what no Connecticut court would do. And on a December day in 2013, U.S. District Judge Charles Haight Jr. granted Scott Lewis federal habeas relief. The state had suppressed exculpatory and impeachment evidence. Hidden proof that could have cleared Lewis. Hidden proof that could have exposed the witnesses against him as unreliable. Proof that had been in the state's possession the entire time that Lewis sat in a cell. The Second Circuit affirmed. In February 2014, Scott Lewis walked out of a Connecticut prison. He had been locked up since his mid-20s. He was now closing in on 50. All charges were dismissed on August 5th, 2015. The city of New Haven settled for $9.5 million in August 2017. Early in discovery, before Lewis's lawyers had taken a single deposition. Basically, the city looked at what was coming and decided it would rather write a check than let the full story emerge in a courtroom. Lewis became a licensed real estate broker. He opened offices in Avon and Wallingford. He married. He had a daughter. He had wanted to sell real estate when he was 25. He started at nearly 50. In 2018, a group of Yale undergraduates made a documentary about his case. They called it 120 Years. It won Best Short Documentary at the Pan-African Film Festival, an Oscar-qualifying festival. More than 200 people attended at the premiere at Yale. Lewis was there. So is Professor Dingham. A film about a man's life being stolen, screened at the university down the road from the police station where it happened. Stefan Morant, 21 years. What defines Stefan Morant's case is not the 70-year sentence, though that is heavy enough. It is not the 21 years he served, though those years were taken from him as cleanly as if someone had cut them out with scissors. It's this. Morant went to prison because he refused to do something wrong. Rauchy, the detective who worked for a drug kingpin, wanted Morant as a witness. Morant said no, so Rauchy made him a defendant. That was 1994. Morant was convicted on June 8th and sentenced to 70 years. He entered the system as a man who had been offered a way out. Lie, and you walk free. and he chose prison instead. Not metaphorically, literally. He chose decades in a cell over a false statement against another human being. When Lewis's federal habeas victory came through in 2013, the legal architecture that had held both men collapsed. If Lewis's conviction was built on fabricated evidence, then the case against his supposed getaway driver couldn't stand either. Prosecutors offered Morant a deal. Plead to a reduced sentence of 25 years, time served, walk out immediately. He took it. And after 21 years, anyone would take it. But the deal, it came with a cost that didn't appear on the paperwork. A reduced sentence is not an exoneration. Morant walked out of prison on June 17, 2015. But he walked out as a convicted felon. A man on the registry. A man who couldn't vote. Who carried the weight of a murder conviction everywhere he went. Not because he hadn't done anything, but because the system that had wrongly imprisoned him for two decades could not bring itself to simply say so. It took six more years. On October 29th, 2021, the Connecticut Board of Pardons and Paroles granted Stephane Morant an absolute and unconditional pardon. 27 years after his conviction, 6 years after his release. A lifetime after a gas station meeting where a dirty cop asked him to lie and he said no. He married his childhood sweetheart in 2016. They reconnected while he was still in prison. And she was, in his words, his key. He now serves on the Innocent Project's Exoneree Advisory Council. He mentors others and speaks publicly about what was done to him. His federal lawsuit, filed May 2022, names the city former chief Nicholas Pastor, Ralchi, and several other officers. The state approved nearly $6 million in compensation in February of 2025. Nearly $6 million for 21 years. That works out to about $278,000 per year. That's what Connecticut's formula says a stolen year is worth. For context, in 2023, a single New Haven police officer earned $259,000, most of it overtime. An officer can earn in 1 year of overtime what the state has determined a wrongfully imprisoned man's stolen year is worth. Morant got 20 of those years back, on paper, at the government rate. Adam Carman, 28 years. On February 3rd, 1994, someone fired shots into a ground floor apartment at 810 Orchard Street in New Haven's Hill neighborhood. 7-month-old Daniel Taft was killed. Her grandmother, Charlene Troutman, was paralyzed. Adam Carman was convicted in 1995 and sentenced to 85 years. There was no physical evidence, no DNA, no fingerprints, and no ballistics linking him to a weapon. The case was built on two eyewitness identifications. Witnesses who saw the shooter for approximately 3 seconds at night. What the jury did not know, because the prosecution did not tell them, was that a man named Brantley had confessed to involvement in the shooting and named another person as the gunman. This information was in the state's possession. They suppressed it. 28 years later, Superior Court Judge John Alander took the case apart, piece by piece, 51 pages. The evidence the prosecution was required to disclose and had buried instead. The firearms analysis that didn't hold up, the eyewitness identifications made in conditions that rendered them scientifically unreliable. At the end of those 51 pages, Alander wrote a sentence that will outlive everyone in this case. How could anyone have confidence in a verdict of guilty in a case such as this? On June 13th, 2023, Judge Alander dismissed the case with prejudice, meaning the charges could never be brought again. He looked at Adam Carman and said five words. The criminal justice system failed you. Carman had entered prison at 22. He walked out at 50. Every birthday from his early 20s to his 50th, every one was spent inside a facility for a crime he did not commit, on evidence that a judge would later describe as insufficient to produce confidence in any reasonable person. A baby was murdered, her grandmother was paralyzed, and instead of finding the person responsible, the New Haven Police Department built a case on coerced identifications, suppressed confessions, and a prosecutor's willingness to not look too closely at what the detectives put in front of him. A federal lawsuit followed. The city, they tried to argue isolation. One case, one set of detectives, nothing systematic. A federal judge rejected that argument, stripped the detectives' legal shields, and let the case proceed. The case has been assigned to a settlement conference. It is not over. George Gould, 26 years. On the 4th of July, 1993, someone robbed and murdered a bodega owner named Eugenio Vega at La Casa Green on Grand Avenue. George Gould was convicted on February 1st, 1995, and sentenced to 80 years. His co-defendant, Ronald Taylor, received the same. No fingerprints, no DNA, no forensic evidence of any kind. The entire case, every brick, every wall, every load-bearing beam, rested on the testimony of one woman. Her name was Miss Stiles. She was the only witness who placed Gould at the scene. And years later, under oath, she explained exactly how that came to be. Police picked her up while she was already in opioid withdrawal. They questioned her for hours, hours during which her body was beginning to convulse. She was an addict, which meant the system had already decided what she was worth. Not enough to protect, but enough to use. The detectives identified her need. And they filled it, not to help her, but to purchase what came next. They bought drugs for me. They bought me clothes. They took me out to eat. They took care of my needs. And they made it real easy for me to just keep going on with that lie. That quote sits at the top of this episode because it is the clearest description of how the machine worked. Not from the inside, but from underneath it. The detectives found a woman the system had already failed. They leveraged her desperation, and they converted her suffering into a statement that would send two men to prison for the length of a human life. Stiles was not a co-conspirator. She was another kind of casualty. Someone whose addiction made her exploitable and whose exploitation was then called evidence. Gould's co-defendant, Ronald Taylor, he never saw the outside. He died of cancer on October 25th, 2011, still serving an 80-year sentence, still convicted. The exoneration that came later arrived 13 years too late for him. The Connecticut Conviction Integrity Unit eventually produced a 74-page report on Gould's case. The report was so damning that the prosecution lost confidence in the conviction. On February 1st, 2024, exactly 29 years to the day after his conviction, Judge Gerald Harmon vacated it. New evidence had surfaced. Two of Vega's own relatives told the FBI that Vega's son, Carlos De Leon, had confessed to killing his father after he had discovered embezzlement. The victim's son. The killer may have been in the family the entire time. And George Gould sat in a cell for 26 years because a woman in withdrawal told detectives what they wanted to hear in exchange for the drugs they were willing to provide. Where the architect ended up. You have been patient. In the previous chapter, Vincent Rauchy Jr. resigned from the New Haven Police Department, and he walked away with a pension. The chapter ended, and you were left with the image of a man who manufactured convictions, who worked for a drug kingpin, who framed two innocent men for murder, and who faced no consequences. Here's what happened next. After his resignation, Rauchy was charged with larceny for overbilling overtime and domestic abuse for beating his ex-wife in front of their children. He pleaded no contest, and he received a suspended sentence. And then he did what any man with a guilty conscience and a packed bag does. He jumped bail and vanished. He reappeared in Silver City, New Mexico, where the FBI and local sheriff's deputies tracked him to a mobile home. Rauchy's response to their arrival, it was a four-hour standoff. He eventually surrendered, was extradited to Connecticut, and, in a flourish that should surprise no one who's been paying attention to how institutions handle this man, was never convicted of the underlying charges. He went back to New Mexico, he settled in, and he found a new professional community. In March 2023, police searched a trailer belonging to Rauchy, who is now going by the nickname Mad Dog, in connection with a woman's disappearance. Inside the trailer, they found a case of crystal meth, fentanyl, a digital scale, a stolen motorcycle, and three other people. The detective who coached a teenager with schizophrenia and a false testimony. The cop who carried a badge for New Haven and a paycheck from a cocaine kingpin. The man who punished Scott Lewis for leaving the drug trade and punished Stefan Morant for telling the truth. He ended up in a trailer in the desert, surrounded by the same category of substances he'd once been paid to police, going by a name that suits him better than the title that he held for 15 years. As of April 2024, Vincent Rauchy Jr., age 68, is in custody at the Grant County Detention Center in New Mexico. Two counts of trafficking controlled substances, receiving stolen property, unlawful carrying of a loaded firearm. He has failed to appear for court six times on the weapons charge alone. His attorney says he will be vindicated. Scott Lewis is selling real estate in Connecticut. Stefan Morant is mentoring other exonerees. Adam Carmen is a free man. George Gould is suing the city. And Rauchy, the architect, is finally on the other side of the wall. The question this chapter cannot answer. Four men, 94 years, four cases built on the same methods, coached witnesses, suppressed evidence, prosecutors who looked the other way. But these four, they're not the whole story. They're not even close. And Rauchy, for everything he did, is not the part that should keep you up at night. Here is what should. Rauchy got caught, not by the system, not by his supervisors, not by the prosecutors who used his work to win convictions. He got caught because he could not stop being a criminal on his own time. The crack use, the drug kingpin's payroll, the arm standoff in a trailer, the meth, the nickname. Vincent Rauchy Jr. was a dirty cop who was also, on a basic operational level, sloppy. The FBI found him because a confidential informant mentioned his drug habit. He was visible because he was reckless. But the detectives who worked alongside him, the ones whose names you haven't heard yet, they were not reckless. They didn't use drugs with associates. They didn't work for kingpins. They didn't jump bail or end up in standoffs or go by Mad Dog. They showed up. They did their jobs. They built the cases. And then they went home. And the cases they built were constructed with a precision that Rauchy never managed. A technique so clean, so procedurally invisible, that it survived habeas petition after habeas petition. It fooled judge after judge, and it held up for decades. Rauchy was a one-man show. He wrote, directed, and performed his own productions, and he left fingerprints all over the stage. That's why he got caught. That's why he ended up in a trailer in New Mexico with a bag of meth and a nickname. The careful ones understood something that Rauchy never did. A production that holds up under scrutiny, the kind that survives appeal after appeal, that convinces not just one jury, but seven reviewing judges, requires more than one man. It requires a company. Someone to direct the witnesses. Someone to dress the set. Someone to make sure the props the audience shouldn't see never make it to the stage. Someone to manage the whole production from above and ensure that nobody, not a supervisor, not a prosecutor, and not a judge, ever sees the backstage. It took a Yale professor, a formerly incarcerated journalist, and over 50 law students, 7 years of investigation to even describe what they were looking at. When they finally documented the method across 8 cases, spanning 2 decades, the scope of what they found was not a rogue detective. It was a full production, with a role for everyone involved. Staged so convincingly that the audience never once thought to look behind the curtain. Troy Streeter, he spent 23 years in prison for a murder he had a church alibi for. Every witness against him has since recanted. Every single one. His case was not built by Rauchy. It was built by the company. And the way that they staged it is the subject of everything that follows. The next chapter takes you backstage. The pre-interview. The rehearsal before the tape rolled. A technique perfected across 2 decades and never documented until a Yale journalism class started pulling at threads. The detectives, the careful ones, are named in the next chapter. Their cases are laid out. Their methods are described with the precision of someone who has seen every page in the file. And the woman who cracked the wall? The one we told you about in chapter 1. The one who walked into the Connecticut State Capitol. You will hear who she is and what she confirmed from the closest possible vantage point. That's next time. Settling Accounts is a production of the Hidden Ledger Podcast. This investigation draws on reporting by the Hartford Courant, the New Haven Independent, CT Mirror, the Yale Investigative Reporting Lab, and court filings in the United States District Court for the District of Connecticut. Full source citations are available at thenightauditor.com. If this investigation matters to you, subscribe wherever you listen, share it with someone, and join the companion newsletter at substack.com for documents, source material, and updates between episodes. Thanks for listening.